I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Adding garbage to more garbage just gives us a bigger pile of garbage.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to your second your favorite hour of fantasy baseball analysis under the radar. I'm Ian Khan, stepping in at the beginning for Nando DeFino. With me, as always, your friend and mine, Derek Van Riper.
It is both a privilege and a contractual obligation for me to say that Under the Radar is presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards.
And also joining us for the very first time, my friend. Maybe the best fantasy baseball player in the whole wide world.
Oh, my goodness.
It could be. My friend and yours, Alex Cushing. Alex, welcome to Under the Radar.
Gentlemen, what's cracking? I'm happy to be here. I'm honored to join.
Well, you know, you're our second guest of this period of time while Nando is out for a bit, and really excited to have you on. I spoke to a couple of friends who were like, wow, I get to hear what Cushing sounds like. You've spoken about him for so many years now on the show. So Nando will be back with us soon, but we're really, really happy to have Alex with us. Alex is truly one of the best fantasy baseball players all around. I mean, he's one of he has been the thorn in my side in this dynasty league for the past, gosh, 9 years. And in redraft, he may just be the best. I mean, he has been in GDD. We've been playing for years, and he's won that league more than anyone else has. He put up a year of 148 points in a 15-team redraft league. I think it was 148. It was something ridiculous like that. And he's either first, second, or third, depending on the year. But he's always good, always good. And we're really happy to have you on. Now,
that is ridiculously high praise. There's only going downhill from here, right?
Well.
I mean, there's no replacing Nando, but I'll do my best. And I'm honored to be on with you guys.
Well, I'll tell you one thing I learned is that it's not a lot of fun to be the host. I learned that last week. It's a tough job. And thank you again to Glenn Colton for joining us last week. It was super fun to have him. But I'm going to hand the show over to the best host in the business. Sorry, Nando. I didn't mean to really put it like that. But Derek Van Riper is about as good as you get. So no need for me to hold that spot. I will come back to close the show in Nando DeFino style. But DVR, off to you, pal.
All right. Well, Alex, I got a question for you that I think a lot of people are always wondering about when they hear anybody on a podcast for the first time. How did you get into fantasy baseball? What's your background and what do you do full time, since this is not something that you do 80 hours a week for money?
Well, for a period of time, I was doing this full time. I worked for Major League Baseball once upon a time. And but even before that, long before that, this was always a passion of mine. As it is for anybody who does this, you know, on their off hours. I like to say I went from breastfeeding to number crunching.
All right, how did that happen?
I think, you know, playing fantasy baseball as early as, I think it dated back to the early 90s, when Benito Santiago was playing. This was when we were playing with USA Stats, when you had to wait 2 weeks to get stats delivered to you, and you would call people up on the phone for trades, and there was no internet.
Well, I like that. That I like.
That's so for a period of time, that went into, you know, I got a job working for Major League Baseball for several years. I do something far less exciting now that I won't bore you with. And anyway, this I've stayed up with it, and I haven't been able to kick the addiction to this game. I do like to delve into stats, so I do consider myself to be more on the stat nerd side, you could say, the stat head side. And that's why Ian and I work well together, because he's more of a intangibles guy, you could say. But I listen to you too, DVR. So I'm probably more on your side of things and Eno. But you do have to factor in intangibles as well. Anyway, so I do, in the off season, I find myself doing a lot of projections and preparation for drafts. Whereas with Ian, I'm marveled because we'll speak on the phone and preparing for an auction. And he does a lot of it by feel in terms of, and it's just interesting to see the different approaches.
Yeah, we definitely do have very different approaches. But there's one spot that you and I both, I think, have a passion for that I think is undervalued, certainly in dynasty leagues, but also in redraft leagues. I talked about this on the show, I think it was last week or the week before, Fantasy Central, Micah, who just got hired by NBC Sportsline to do fantasy content over there. His pin quote, I really should just pull it up, actually, because it's so smart. But it's about how you win a fantasy league.
Mm-hmm.
And what he says, fantasy championships are achieved through one, commitment, and two, the waiver wire. And, you know, I think it's undervalued in terms of dynasty leagues, mm-hmm. how important the waiver wire is. Because everyone talks about, oh, the trading, it's about the trading. You make these amazing trades. How do you get people to make trades with you like that? No, that's not what it is. What it is for me is the guys that you find on Sundays, the waiver wire pickups that turn into something bigger that then become the pieces that you use to get the players. And, you know, Alex and I have been in this Dynasty League One that we've been playing opposite each other for nine years now.
Yeah, it's been a long time, hasn't it?
It's been a long time now of sort of just like, and you know, this is Yankees Red Sox here. These are with Alex and I. I mean, we are Yankees Red Sox. We were blood rivals for years. I mean, for years, we wouldn't even talk because it was just like, I'm going to beat this guy. And then there came a certain point where I was like, you know what? He's so dang smart. I got to be his friend. And he's a good guy. And I want to be his friend. And so since then, my game has gotten better by being friends with him. But here's what I found. Every Monday morning on the waiver wire fab, one of the good things about CBS is that they really do tell you like everybody and what they bid and everything. Cushing's waiver wire pickups are brilliant. And we went over, I think it was last week, we were on the phone and just talking about guys that we've picked up off the wire in this league and how important that is. And so I think the major point that I wanted to make was every Sunday you have a chance to make your team significantly better, especially in a dynasty league. And you should. DVR, before we hit Alex with it, because I know he has a lot of thoughts about it. DVR, what do you think about this idea?
I think in-season management is, especially if you're using FAB, one of the hardest things to learn how to do exceptionally well. And I think even when you know what you're supposed to do, it is even more difficult to have the discipline to do it. And as you guys have seen firsthand in GDD, when I get frustrated by something about my team, maybe it's a lack of pitching, for example, I might throw a very large bid at a young player, hoping that that young player is going to come up and save my season, which mathematically is a bad play. It is a negative EV play. Ariel Cohen has written about this. Several other people have written about this and studied this. You guys know it from experience. You don't throw 20% of your budget at Davey Garcia because your pitching isn't good. That is a mistake. That is a tactical error. That is like, if you're playing tennis, since we talk about tennis sometimes in this show, it's like hitting your second serve as hard as your first serve because you're mad you missed your first serve, right? You're more likely to miss on the second serve when you do that. It's that sort of lack of discipline. And that's exactly how I played tennis, by the way. I played tennis in high school. That was one of my biggest flaws. I'd get mad. I'd miss the first serve and say, F it. I'm ripping the second one. And I had double fault. And then, you know, you just throw away a point like that. That's my biggest flaw as a player. So I'm really curious, Alex. I'm looking back through just the GDD bids for this year. How long did it take you to realize that big splashy FAB moves are generally just a bad idea?
I think it's dependent on what your position is. Sometimes a splashy move is necessary to some degree. I mean, you want it to be on the right player. Someone who pops into mind is your main Mercedes. I spent maybe the first week more than most people did. I was really worried about my hitting in a number of leagues. or at least in a couple of leagues. And I think I spent 26 to 20, close to 30% of my budget on him, which I think was higher than most. A lot of people were out on him because he was a late bloomer, and there was uncertainty about his playing time moving forward.
Not Nando DeFino.
Not Nando DeFino. Everybody but Nando DeFino. And I think, isn't that what's magical about our game, is that late bloomers are far more common in baseball than they are in, let's say, basketball. You had someone like Jeremy Lin for a minute, and then he faded to the background. But in baseball, I find that to be so magical about our game, is that you see guys like your Mean Mercedes come on at age, what is he, 28, 27. And, you know, Cliff Lee comes to mind as somebody who didn't emerge until late. But with the waiver wire, my approach is it generally takes a lot of time for me to come up with an order, for me to come up with a bid. There's no real science to it, is the problem. Whereas when you're preparing for a draft, you have some idea, you have some projection on what you think someone's going to produce for a full season. But, and you can kind of say, well, this is the dollar value I think he will produce by season's end. And then you can translate it into draft or auction form. But there's no real science that I've seen to translating it to fab form and in terms of how much you should invest in a player for the rest of the season. I don't know if you guys have that, but I end up putting in maybe 20 bids in total for 1 week. And I actually don't enjoy fab that much. It feels
no, it's
like,
hard.
It feels like work sometimes. It feels like it's not always the setting the lineup part is what's really enjoyable. The looking at splits, the seeing, oh, is it's lefty facing, like Jake Fraley comes to mind as a hot new pickup. Looking at his weekly matchups now, I just noticed there were a lot of lefties. So I really want to play Jake Fraley, but he's facing a lot of lefties. So that part of it I always find interesting is how that factors into your fab. And that did affect my fab with Jake Fraley, that his matchups, what does he have? He's facing four lefties, I think, this week, and he's a lefty hitter. That matters. I mean, you do want to invest because I do think Jake Fraley could be something because he did this in the minors.
Then one of the things that Cushing does that I think is a little nuts. I mean, he really, and actually I argue it a little bit in terms of the hitting. Like, I would rather go with a better hitter than focus as much on the matchups, where Alex is really focusing on the matchups. I know you use the Tristan Cockcroft, the planning for the week,
right,
for hitters. And that's right. It's almost it's sort of a Bible for you. I would rather, I mean, we share one team right now, and we're going to do this again, because this team is struggling on the pitching side, not on the hitting side. The hitting is remarkable, but on the pitching side, we're struggling, and I think it's going to cap us to, you know, we might finish top three. I think it's a possibility of that if things break right. But when we discuss the hitters, it's one place where you and I do, well, we disagree on a couple of things, but this is a spot where I always want the better hitter. And you really look to the matchups and say, yeah, but they're facing all righties, and this guy, you know, just struggles more against righties. But I think that there's value for it. I mean, you put a lot of time and effort into it, don't you? I mean, you spend, how long do you spend on each fab for each league, would you say?
I would say a couple of hours per week at least. You know, I mean, and not everybody always has time for that.
But not for each league. You don't spend like 2 hours on GDD. You'll spend 30 minutes on GDD.
I'm in five or six leagues, so mm-hmm. I'll spend that for the entire time. But I have to take breaks and come back to it because it's and a lot of times you have to start earlier, a day earlier than mm-hmm. fab goes, but then you have to adjust based on what's happened since. But I do think, you know, you can't ignore if somebody's just hitting well and they have poor matchups. You have to start them. But if it's for guys on the margins like Jake Fraley, whoever else comes to mind, like a
Kevin Newman versus Matt Carpenter.
That was right off the top of my head. I was about to say Kevin Newman. That's somebody who could make the lineup if you're in a deep league, like a 15 mm-hmm. team. That's somebody who could make the lineup if he has good matchups. anyway, there are a number of guys who you can play that game with. But if there are guys that are struggling, like Ian Happ for a period of time, like Joey Gallo, we had some dispute over.
The thing
about Joey Gallo, and I've said this on the show, and I said it to you.
Right.
I said the good thing about Gallo is that when he's not hitting, he runs. Like, there's something emotional about him where he's like, all right, I'm not hitting, but I just got on base with a walk. I'm stealing a base, you know? And I like guys like that because right now Gallo has 11 home runs. Good, fine. Okay, not as good as we want. 34 runs, 28 RBIs, but he's got six steals. I mean, six steals is a pretty big deal in any format that you're in.
That's true.
That, and that from does, a power guy.
That does pad his, I guess that does alleviate the pain of a 220 batting average.
Yeah, certainly.
I actually hadn't seen that he had six steals. The last I looked, he was at three or something.
Yeah, he's stolen three bases this week, I think, or two. Certainly, I mean, he's running. He's in a running mode for himself, and that's something that I've always believed about Gallo. It's like he's one of those dangerous players. Back in the day, you would say it about Justin Upton as well. It's like you can take Justin Upton struggling. Oh my God, he's struggling. But then all of a sudden, he's going to go kapow and have like a ridiculous week. So you really want to keep him in your lineup. That's how I feel about Gallo.
And looking at him a little closer with Gallo, it's really interesting. I didn't see that his splits, he's raking against lefties and struggling versus righties. So maybe that's a sign of better things to come. Because usually he struggled against lefties, or at least he did, not always actually, but at least he did last year. And that's something to be considerate of with other lefty hitters.
DVR, what are your feelings on Gallo?
I think we kind of just know what he is as a player at this point. I mean, the K rate wasn't ever going to come down since we've got several years of 30%+, but he's always walked, and he has had, I think, a pretty clear track record of being more athletic than the typical three true outcomes masher. Like those long tail deals that I call them, those are real. Yeah. Like he's got them. Like if you go back through his career, you got a 7, you got a 4, you got a 6 this year. 2 in the shortened season, like some of the years where he missed time, it lowers the total and you don't think he runs that much. But a half dozen steals does make a difference on the margins a lot of times. Look at this category in most leagues and think about your team with 6 more steals. It could be 3 or 4 standings points in a lot of situations. So I think there is some bounce back potential, but I think we kind of know what that bounce back is going to look like. There's not another level there that he hasn't reached. Like he would have shown something by now.
It's coming, I'm telling you.
I think there might be, though. I tend to agree with Ian. If you look at his minor league career, there were a period of times when he hit above 240. So I think there might be, I remember it, like with Gallo, Aaron Hicks was similar, where he would struggle upon his first sight of a new level. And then after a couple of years, he would really adapt. And if you look back at some of his minor league numbers, there might be another level, because he's one of those guys like Gallo, reminding me of Teoscar Hernandez in a way, where it's all hard hit ball. And the strikeout numbers are high. So the hard hit is just so otherworldly, and the barrels, that if he just cuts his strikeout rate just a tiny bit, he could take off. I think there might be a career year at some point.
I think, and he's also, guys, let's remember something. He's been around for a number of years, right? He came up early. And if we go back to the very first show of Under the Radar, where we talked about freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year, he is still in his sophomore year as a career. He's got another 10 years. He's only played 4 or 5 seasons, right? Something like that. And he's got another 10 years to come. I'm going to make an argument that a Joey Gallo could be conceived, and certainly in an OBP league, definitely like Devil's Rejects, where Alex and I play together. We're not on the same team, but we oppose each other. Joey Gallo is a buy low still. I still believe that, and you never know. There, you could see him get moved. I mean, can you imagine? He's got the athletic ability to handle playing center field. Not every day, right? Like you don't really want to play him every day in center field. But if he went to the New York Yankees with that right field porch, he would be popping balls up to right field that would be home runs. So I just think that there's more upside here for Joey Gallo. I think that even with his struggles with the 220 average, right now at CBS, he was projected for 107 as to be the 107th best player. Right now he's at 113, and nobody is happy quite. Nobody feels that he's fulfilled his potential yet. So I don't know. I just think that there's still upside in Joey Gallo. There's still upside in Joey Gallo. I keep saying that.
I think the fact that he's running, I mean, this leads to a larger conversation about the Rangers, but the fact that he's running it does pad some of the pain caused by the batting average, which I there aren't many signs that he's going to shake the batting average woes. But, you know, the running, like with Nate Lowe, or no, is it Nate? I always get confused. Nate Lowe.
It's Brandon Lowe and Nate Lowe.
It's an Abbott and Costello we're seeing, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here as in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
DVR, can I ask you one thing? Because you didn't answer this. On the Fab, how long do you spend working on Fab on the weekend?
It takes a couple hours for me. Like probably on average 2 hours to get through, I want to say it's 8 leagues I have that actually use Fab. And you know, two of those leagues are mono leagues. And we've talked about this before. If you're in an AL only or an NL only league, it takes you like 3 minutes to do Fab because you're sorting by playing time.
Everything comes
into a zero real quick.
But at the same time, in the AL, I spend more time, in AL labor, I spend more time trying to figure out what everyone else is going to bid, right?
I do.
Like this past week, I have Diego Castillo on my AL labor team, and he's the closer, right? Or kind of the closer for the Tampa Bay Rays. Peter Fairbanks was on the wire this week. I don't know how he got there. I don't know when he got there, but he's there. He was there. And I decided to spend $13 out of $100. And I had $53 left, and I decided to spend 13 of those dollars on Peter Fairbanks to kind of, and not fully lock it down because JP Fireson, I think that's how you say his name, could come back, could hop back in there. I think I'm starting to figure out how Kevin Cash thinks about closing. I think this, and this is worth saying, I'm just going to quick sidebar. This is what he does. He like gives everybody like a chance at it for a couple of days, just so they know they can do it. Like, now, because Fireson came to the team, he put him right into the closer role. And I was like, what are you doing? Well, he's proven, he's done it. And now, okay, now you go to the seventh. Diego Castillo, he can close for you. Now he goes to the eighth. Now Fairbanks, he's there. Now he's the closer for the last 2 days. So in an only league where you're starting a middle reliever, typically, right? I'm going to have a Greg Holland in there on the upside that he might get a save or something like that. To be able to pair Fairbanks with Castillo, I thought was, and I think, is really valuable because I also have Liam Hendricks in that league. So I'm really growing my saves lead in that league so that eventually, probably in about a month, I can move Hendricks, have the lead still, move Hendricks for a bat that I could probably use or maybe a starter that I could use and get somebody really good for that because saves in an only league are incredibly hard to come by. So if you can move a top save guy who has fulfilled that, you can get a lot back. So I spent, and I thought to myself, I said, you know what I think it's going to cost to get him? $7. I think someone's going to bid $6. I think $7 would do it. In fact, I called Ariel and discussed it with him. He said, well, you know, Ian, if you're thinking about it, he's worth more to you than he is to anybody else. I mean, because nobody else really wants to spend all their money to maybe get half or a third of the saves, but you can lock down 72%. Of the save content moving forward for saves. So I think it's a really good move. Sorry, it just came out. But the reason was because before the season, when I was talking with Ariel and Alex, I spent a lot of time talking with Alex too about auction strategy going into labor and Tout Wars. Ariel said, you know, if you get all three of the closers for Tampa Bay, that'd be a really good thing to get, really. Because if you think about it, it'll help you with your ratios. You'll lock down saves, but it was too expensive because Nick Anderson went for 13, Castillo went for 8, and Fairbanks went for 7. So I said, you know what? I'm going to take the Castillo for 8, and then I'll pay the 23 for Liam Hendricks, which is what's put me into the position of leading in saves. But now, then I traded for Nick Anderson while he was on the IL, and then I picked up Fairbanks. So I actually have the three-headed monster for the close of the season. And that's why I called him. I was like, doesn't this make sense that I would spend this? So I said to myself, I think 7 buys it for me. I'm going to bid 13 because I want him. I want to lock this down. And so, you know, that's why I spent a good amount of time, more time thinking in the only league that I play in, more time thinking about it. So you spent 2 hours. Cushing, you spent 2 to 3 hours. You guys are in 6 to 8 leagues. I'm also in 8 leagues. One of the advantages is I have Robert Mershak as a partner in 3 leagues. So Robert and I do those together, which is great. You know, so we'll both kind of throw guys in and then we'll sit down and discuss it. We'll probably spend about 45 minutes on Sunday going through those. And then I do the leagues that I have by myself and one with Dr. Thomas Scott, which we do with DVR, which is on Thursdays, which is awesome. So I do spend a good amount of time. And I think the point that could be gleaned from this is that it takes time. And that it makes a difference. So that, you know, Alex, in DL1, who is the best guy that you have picked up off? Give me your 2 to 3 best guys that are still on your team and that are actively helping that you got on the waiver wire for $1 to $50. Doesn't matter. But I know one of them off the top of my head. I know one for sure.
And I have two off the top of my head, and then I'm struggling to think about too many, but the top one was Woodruff a few years ago.
Right, and I remember the day you picked him up because Woodruff had just come up and he had been throwing really well. I think it was 2018, I want to say. Maybe it was 19, early to mid-19. Just when Woodruff started to show himself, right? He just started to show, and I remember you picking him up and going, damn, that might be really good for him. And now it's turned into Brandon Woodruff off the wire.
It's interesting when you think about some of the waiver wire successes you've had. For me, I always think about the ones that got away. And when you mentioned the best pickups in that league, I remember someone picking up Jacob DeGrom for a few dollars. And this is a dynasty league, so lots of guys were already owned. So DeGrom was a pop-up prospect. He was not a big prospect. And he only went for less than 1%. He went for $5 out of 1,000.
And what did you bid? Do you remember?
It was 3 or something.
Bid 3.
So that, when you say the best pickups, I don't think about my successes. I think about somebody else's successes. I think about somebody else grabbing DeGrom for $5 out of a 1,000 and just how valuable he is.
That's your first one was Woodruff. Who's your second one?
The one that comes to mind now is Mercedes. I'm sure there's better. There was Josh Rojas. There was Jeff McNeil, who's not.
Oh,
doing
I remember
so
when
hot.
You got Jeff McNeil too. See, I remember all of these things, and you just did it this weekend. You bid 26, and I bid 25 on the kid from San Francisco.
Right on Sammy Long.
On Sammy
who,
Long,
who I think could be something because
yeah,
and this goes back to the kind of late bloomers. I think he's 25, so he's not exactly a prospect, and he was never really on anyone's radar.
Well, the three guys that I've picked up in that league that are still contributing for my team are all late bloomers. They're all these guys. So, I mean, I guess that's the titled episode of the show. My three are Jared Walsh last year picked up for $1. Yeah. Jared Walsh picked him up for $1 in like July, right? He came up and he hit and I was like, oh, I'm grabbing him. And especially in dynasty leagues, I like grabbing guys who just came up and who popped up and kind of show a little bit because you can stick him down in your minors, let it play out for a couple of weeks. And then, you know, I did it with Tucker Davidson a couple of weeks ago. Rob and I bid like $50 on Tucker Davidson because it was like, you know what? Brett Sayre is always talking about Tucker Davidson with me saying how great he's going to be. All right, I'll take a flyer on him. We'll see how he does tonight. But so Jared Walsh, and then going back a couple of years, but guys who are still contributing, I remember picking up Mark Canha on the wire. And then the last one is Luke Voit. You know, I mean, I picked up Luke Voit in that league for $8 and then that. Spent, yeah. And then, and now have, I mean, he's hurt now, obviously, but that DVR, do you find the same thing DVR in dynasty leagues or in keeper leagues that the wire can be so valuable if you take the time to look?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're not contending in any given year, you should be churning on the wire constantly because you will make your team a lot better that way without having to give something to get something. Like if your long-term plan on a keeper or dynasty league is to just trade away the expensive players that you get in the auction, or if it's a dynasty league, the veteran players, those players don't return that much in trades. You know, everybody who's good in a dynasty league or a keeper league clutches the elite of the elite prospects, and it's actually kind of difficult to get a lot better in a dynasty draft sometimes too, because those leagues are so big. There's only a handful of impact guys up top. Like, you're going to find more pop-up guys that make an impact. All those guys you described, for the most part, are players that did not have big pedigrees as prospects. I mean, like when we had RDI a few years ago, I picked up Voit, ended up trading him in a bad trade, but found him on the wire nonetheless. Tommy Edman, you know, is a guy that Tommy popped Edman. Up out of nowhere, provided a ton of value. Like, you will find a huge number of players that could be like $15 to $20 players over a full redraft season, and you can get them for a min bid or a near min bid in a lot of deep leagues.
Tommy Edman is a perfect example. I didn't mention him because he's no longer on the team, but this is why everyone's like, oh, you make the trade. No. I picked up Tommy Edman in that league. Remember that, Kush?
I do.
I picked up Tommy Edman. I had Tommy Edman on my team for the last year and a half. He played for me. He helped us win last year, right? I picked up Leody Taveras also on the wire last year when he first came up, because guys like Nick Gordon, who I just picked up this week, right, this past Sunday, these are former prospects that have fallen on harder times. It's why learning the prospect is so valuable. But now watch. Tommy Edman cost me, I don't remember, $10. Leody Taveras cost me $2. In the offseason, I traded a very hot Leody Taveras, where everyone was hot on Leody, and Tommy Edman for Shohei Ohtani. Right? Isn't that exactly what the trade was, Coach? Right? Well, and at the time, at the time, Leody was on the rise, right? Leody is the speed guy. He's going to be the starting center fielder. He's going to run. Tommy Edman has got a guaranteed playing time, also going to run. Ohtani, we really don't know what's going to happen with him, right? But that's the freaking point. That's the freaking point.
I think the theme that we're echoing here is that you don't always have to hit a home run on the wire. It's important to have a number of producers. And I think that's what winds up turning people off when they look at the wire. They don't see a difference maker necessarily right away. But there are guys constantly like the future Tommy Edmonds. Someone who comes to mind is like a Gurriel, a Yuli Gurriel, who, you know, for a number of years ago, somebody who just produces constantly, a Chris Taylor years ago, somebody who just finds his way into your lineup every single week. And if you look at every winning team, they have boring veterans, not the shiny toys that everybody is clamoring for, but boring veterans who just produce year in and year out. They're giving you $20+ results. And I think that's really important when you look at the wire and when you're drafting too, is you do want to have a nice collection of boring veterans. They don't have to be boring veterans, but just guys who will produce, who are not who everyone is not talking about. I mentioned Chris Taylor, Mark Canna you mentioned. These are guys who will produce, who don't get a lot of fanfare. And I think it's important to emphasize that. The thing that takes the most time on the wire, and I do want to have a little rant here, is closers. And I find it so frustrating that the closer game is about speculating who's in the doghouse of the manager and who's not. I just wish we could all go to solds, saves plus holds, because it feels like less skill is involved in picking up a closer who didn't have the job a few weeks ago. Like, you're constantly speculating who the manager likes more. And sometimes it's not always logical. Sometimes it's just based on how he looks Is he fearsome looking? There are all these kind of variables that are not stat based. And it seems odd that that's how we anchor our investments. And I have a pitch for not just with shifting from saves to solds, but I wonder, and this is probably better for a Champions League, you know, a draft and hold and no pickups. I wonder if you just avoided picking guys, closers with secure roles early on, because a lot of them have disappointed. I mean, aside from Hader and Hendricks, if you look at some of the top closers this year, it's Melanson, it's Alex Reyes, right? It's Yimi Garcia.
Yeah, but so I'm gonna definitely come down hard on the other side of this argument. Okay. But before I do that, DVR, what is your thought on that argument? So you know you're breaking the tie.
Well, I've just been frustrated by the same things that Alex is frustrated by, and I think one way to kind of visualize the scope of this problem, one stat that I like just as a good general measure of how effective, how good a pitcher is strikeout minus walk percentage. Usually, if you are good in that category, in that particular stat, you are a good pitcher. So if you go to FanGraphs and you pop open the reliever leaderboard and you sort by K minus BB percentage, you can go through name by name and say, does this guy close for his team? Right? So the first few, Matt Barnes, Liam Hendricks, Josh Hader, Craig Kimbrell, Rolls Chapman, those guys all close. Raisel Iglesias closes. Oh, here's Heath Hembree. He's the seventh best qualified reliever in K minus BB percentage. And do we care about him? Well, he's got a 540 ERA right now, but the skills look good, right? Like, our game should value guys like that. James Karinchak versus Class A. Those guys should have both been rosterable without a doubt. And it shouldn't have been one is a lot more valuable than the other because we think Tito prefers Karinchak to Class A or vice versa. Like, that part of our game is pretty fluky and very luck-based. And I think anywhere we can remove that, that's a good thing. So
you're with Alex.
I'm on board with changing it. Here's my problem, though. I don't like hold as a stat. I think hold is also a garbage stat. So I think adding garbage to more garbage just gives us a bigger pile of garbage.
Why is it but why is it, how is it any, this is, I've heard people say this before, but how is it any different than saves as a stat? It's, you're just holding a lead in a different part of the game.
Oh, they're both bad.
Okay. So that's,
I hate them both.
But then if we widen the scope of it, then we can have some of these quality relievers who ends up getting lots of holds who are good in real life.
I've got a solution. I don't think it works. Tell me why this doesn't work. Okay. But we have innings pitched requirements in most leagues, right? You got to throw, I don't know, 900, 1,000 innings, whatever the number is. It varies from league to league depending on the format. Could we reach a point where we require a certain volume of your innings to come from relievers? Because in that case, you can't just chase the guys who get saves. Then you're going to need the guys who are actually the best relievers to meet that threshold.
All right, I'm jumping in here. Because one thing we're taking out of the game by doing all this is the big-time, heart-wrenching sweat that happens at the end of every game with the saves. Right? And I talked about this before the season. And actually, Glenn Colton talks about this also. Glenn and Rick talk about this in their smart system. I say, make sure, and I did this in almost every league, make sure that you invest in at least one closer who you can guarantee is going to hold that job. Now, there aren't that many of them, right? There's Hendricks, there's Chapman, there's Jansen, there's Kimbrell to a certain extent, there's Hader. Like, but make sure you invest in one of those guys with your draft capital. I spent $23 on Liam Hendricks in both Tout Wars and Labor. And in TGFBI, I think I have him too. And the reason is because I believe that he was the best closer on the best team. I believe that that was what was going to happen. So it's not that Alex's idea of like, let's just spread it out. I kind of get it, but I want to get those. I want to lock down closers in the champions in the NFBC 50 thing. And also, if we take it away, I don't like holds as a stat. In DL1, we changed it from just saves to saves and half holds. That makes more sense to me.
I like
because that. I don't want to have a guy who holds a lead in the sixth inning count as much as a guy who does the saves? Because then it becomes, I really like this, add garbage to garbage to just get more garbage, right? Like that's kind of how it feels to me. But I don't think the save stat is garbage. I think it's a major part of the game. And I think it's a major part of how you spend your fab.
It is a major part. But
right.
But my point in terms of, I'm going to flesh this strategy out a little bit. If you just focused on bullpens, right? If you just said at the start of a season when you're preparing for a draft, let me take a couple of bullpens with guys that I think are good, where the closer situation is unsettled. So let's say you focused on San Diego, I brought up as
right,
an example.
Perfect. That's what
and
I want you.
And if you drafted, let's say there were three guys in the running. Right. So you have to use up
Diego
roster
Castillo,
spots.
You have Diego Castillo, not you have Mark Melanson.
Right. What's his name? Pagan.
Yeah, Pagan, Pomeranz, right. And Melanson, I think, were right. The three that
right.
People
those
were
are the three that, and which is why I was like, I'm not interested in any of this nonsense. But let's take this further. So it's, yes, those are the three.
Because that's a good team, right? And typically, guys in bullpens who saves are produced from a team. The ideal situation for a closer is one where there's a good pitching staff in front of them and the hitting is not awesome, right? But San Diego's a good team. So you knew there were going to be save opportunities. So if you pick, I liked Pomeranz.
Yes.
Yeah, and I liked Pagan. So in one league, I took all three of them. And one hit, and that was a huge hit. Melanson's been about as good as Hendricks, right, in certain ways. Maybe not as good.
And his ADP was 283.
Right, and if you, and let's say you took also Bass and Yimi Garcia with the Marlins. Now, if you took those five relievers, those were five relievers that were legitimately in the running for saves chances, right? You would have two quality closers for nothing. Now, I know it's Monday morning quarterbacking, but I find it odd that we place so much value and investment in guys who pitch 60 to 70 innings per year. I just think, like DBR said, you can look at the skills. But these are guys who pitch, they're short sample sizes. So a couple of outings and it changes it.
Listen, Alex, I think it works for the draft champions. I actually, and we discussed that. I'm sort of sorry you're telling everybody this because next year we're going to. Anyway, but I do think that in draft champions, it makes a certain amount of sense. Because then if you it's 250 for Pomeranz, it was 289 for Melanson. And who's the third? I can't think of his name.
Mark, Matt Barnes is another one if you drafted Barnes and Ottavino, who were in the running.
But see, that's a little bit more dangerous because it's 225, right?
Right,
it's,
right, I guess.
I like it better. I like the idea better if you're in the mid to late 250s and you just ignore closers. But then it comes down to who's going to be available during those times, right? In auctions, how do you think that would play? But see, I can't work in auctions, man. Like you can't draft if you're only taking 30 guys on your team.
Well, you have to build in more roster spots for your relievers, but it's worth it because it's a Liam Hendricks. I have Liam Hendricks in a few leagues, so it seems odd that I'm making this argument. I also had Edwin Diaz a couple of years ago, who was the top closer, and that was a bust, right? And I said to myself, why am I investing in guys who pitch 60 to 70 innings? I know they could produce a lot in terms of just pure dollar values, but we're basing this off of 60 to 70 innings per year versus a starter. There's a much larger sample size. So if you would have to set aside a number of roster spots for that guy, but you could do it in the reserves. You can get Melanson in the reserves. You can get an Alex Reyes in the reserves, right? If you had Gallegos.
Yeah, I avoided St. Louis. I grabbed Reyes. Hold on, let me see where Reyes was before the season because I got him in a bunch of NFBC
leagues.
He was late. Alex Reyes. So I got him. He was at 362, and I got him in. Do we have him on our team? Do we have him?
We do not.
But I was thinking of him more not as a closer, but as a starter.
Right.
Like I thought that eventually he was going to be a starter, and that's why I grabbed him. I avoided all of those situations. I didn't get near them. So is it, DVR? You think this works? Do you like this idea?
I'm kind of wrestling with all of our thoughts a little bit because I've had this sort of statement before. I've said 5x5 roto is an imperfect game, but I'm okay with its flaws. It's sort of like how Tecmo Super Bowl to me will always be the most fun football video game to play, even though for 30 years, every video game has been better than that from a graphic standpoint or a gameplay standpoint or the types of things they're doing.
It's your first love.
Kind of, yeah, it's a little bit of that. And there are actually, if you play Tecmo Super Bowl at a really high level, you realize there's a lot more strategy in it than you would typically give a game from the early 90s credit for. My thinking here with the closer problem, I'm looking at ADP from back in March, and you see, you know, Josh Hader inside the top 60 in the NFBC, and you see like Aroldis Chapman inside the top 70, and mm-hmm. this happens every year because there's no trading in those leagues. Kind of arguing against myself, throwing this to both of you guys, do you think that artificially inflating the value of something that we all agree, I mean, a reliever is half or a third as valuable as a starter, but our game doesn't treat it that way. Does this actually open up a more diverse path to building a competitive team? Does it create more variation in strategy that is utilized?
100%.
If we didn't do this, if we didn't count saves, if we didn't care about these relievers, they would be almost either completely irrelevant or they'd be so devalued that it'd be a bit of a crapshoot. Everyone would just throw darts after pick 200 and get their saves that way.
I played in a league like that in the Tout Wars head-to-head, and I hated it because closers didn't matter at all. You needed to have two closers, but you weren't going to get a lot of points for them. And you're getting most of your points for the innings, right? Innings are everything in a points league like that, in that format. So it really took a part of the game out. It's like people who argue that the two catcher rule is stupid. Like I play in a bunch of leagues where it's just a one catcher league. I don't like that at all. I like two catcher leagues. 100%. I think it makes it harder. I think it makes it more challenging. It adds more variation to the game.
I agree with that. And I'm not advocating for banning relievers necessarily. I just think there are two separate points. There's one about, is there a new way to value relievers properly? And is there a new way to approach relievers in traditional formats? And on the subject of just valuing relievers differently, I do think the magic balancing act is half, as you said before, half save, half hold, half point for a hold, and a full point for a save within the same category. I guess it's less exciting, but then we're playing this silly game otherwise where we're just speculating on who the manager likes best.
No,
and it's not always skills-based. It's not skills-based always.
I'm with Alex on this. Right now, the way we're valuing saves as the default reliever category, we are not tasked with finding the best reliever. We are tasked with finding the best reliever most likely to end up in this particular role, which is just
I think I understand where we're off here. I love it because it's about the psychological part of the game, because then I get to use my psychology skills to get in the mind of the manager. That's what I want to do. I want to look at that. I want to look at the inside of what the manager might be thinking after, you know, if you look at what's happening in San Francisco right now between Rodgers and, my names are just going crazy.
Jake McGee,
right? Like, why is Rodgers gave up two hits the other night? Now Rodgers is in the eighth inning and McGee is back in the ninth inning. What does that mean? Like, you know, is Kapler having big thoughts? Like, what is Kevin Cash thinking? Our old friend Marcus Potter, Alex, when he was really like focusing on fantasy baseball, he had a rule, okay? He had a real rule, which was never draft somebody who is still injured, right? I don't know if I agree with that rule, but it was a rule that he had. I have a rule. Don't spend capital on a closer if you're not sure he's got the job. So James Karinchak did not appear on any of my teams this year at all.
Right.
Francona never came out and said, it's going to be Karinchak. There's one team that I had him on a dynasty league, so I went and got Class A in the draft. And we know that in Devil's Rejects. But that's a rule that I have. If I don't know who the closer is, I'm not going to spend the money on the idea that he's probably going to be the guy. It's the clubhouse rule in closers. Who is it? If the closer loses his job, what's going to be? Is it going to be back page news? God, that's like 20th century conversation. Is it going to be back page news in that city's paper? And those are the guys I want. I want the guys that if you take out Jansen, if you take out Chapman, it's gonna cause a problem. So they're gonna really have to blow it. So I disagree with you guys. The analytics guys are on one side and the psychological intangible guys on the other side. I don't think we're gonna agree. And it's good. It's fine.
I just to close this point, I do think if you embrace the uncertainty of saves rather than feeling as if you needed the security of one guy, I think you find this if you look at the draft champions, the overall leaders, a lot of them, just reviewing some of them, and I encourage anybody out there to check it out, looking at the top 10 to 20 teams, a lot of them don't have top closers. They ended up getting lucky with saves and making profit off of Alex Reyes, the guys we've mentioned already, Kimbrel, guys who were not as top. And since it's such an uncertain position, I would argue embrace the uncertainty and just take a collection of guys from the same, from a couple of bullpens and hope it, like if you embrace the uncertainty with Cleveland, there were a few good relievers there. It just wasn't clear who would get the job, right? Karinchak, we knew he was talented, right? We knew he was talented.
And Class A was 421, so it's not like you had to spend a lot for him. And then, but then there was Whitgren, Nick Whitgren, right?
Right. So if you took all three of them, and Whitgren, I threw a couple dollars at it in deep leagues.
At 397.
Exactly. So if you took all three of them, you would wind up with a top 10 closer. I guess he's top 10, right? I'm kind of.
Well, I mean, Karinchak didn't get the save last night. Class A got the save last night. So the nightmare continues.
Never mind this whole theory.
No. I think this was great. Unfortunately, I'm the one with the heart out today. I've got a business thing that I have to get to. And so DVR, but before we wrap, DVR, do you have any final thoughts that you want to share about the closer situation?
I'll save them for a future episode just because I think there's a lot more here. I'm just curious what people think. So email us, fantasypods@theathletic.com. Tweet at us, of course. We're always interested in getting thoughts. It feels like we need to tweak something. I don't want a full overhaul. I just want to do it a little bit better. I think we can keep the fun aspects of speculating while also doing a better job of rewarding better relievers in each bullpen that we don't currently reward or value as much as we should.
All right. So that'll be something we'll get into. And now I'm going to do my attempt at the Nando DeFino close. So here we go. For the man who knows that adding a hold stat would just add garbage to garbage to just get more garbage, Derek Van Riper.
If you had one bag of garbage and you added two more bags of garbage, you'd have three bags of garbage. And that's worse than having one bag of garbage.
It's a lot of garbage. And welcome and thank you again for joining us for my friend, to the man who went directly from breastfeeding to number crunching, Alex Cushing.
Gentlemen, thank you for having me. It's been
an honor. I'm Ian Khan. And it was a real pleasure to have you, my friend. And we will see you again here next week. Bye.
Good time.